and welcome to the official podcast of the Irish Association of Speech and Language Therapists, the IASLT in Conversation. Today, I am joined by a panel of four SLTs, all working in the area of FEES, fibre optic endoscopic evaluation of swallowing. We'd like to welcome Patricia Gillivan Murphy, clinical specialist based in the Outpatient Voice and Swallowing Clinic at the Mater Hospital. Patricia assesses and treats a range of voice, swallowing and upper airway disorders. She is the clinical lead for the inpatient and outpatient FEES at the Mater, which has developed incrementally over the past 10 years. And she supports FEES training at the Mater and nationally. So welcome, Patricia. Sheila Robinson, senior speech and language therapist in Cork University Hospital. Sheila graduated from Trinity College Dublin, subsequently completed a Master's in Human Communication Science in University College London. She has extensive experience in communication and swallowing difficulties post-stroke, including video fluoroscopy and FEES. She also co-leads the physiotherapy and SLT facial paresis clinic in CUH, the only clinic of its kind in the country. Welcome to Sheila as well. Kira Landy, senior SLT in Our Lady's Hospital, Navan. Kira qualified from the University of Newcastle in 2009 and has since worked across a number of acute hospital settings in both the UK and Ireland. Kira completed video fluoroscopy training in 2012 and FEES training in 2023. Kira was involved in getting funding for nasendoscopy equipment for the SLT service in Navan at the end of 2022 and has carried out 27 FEES studies independently since her training last year. Welcome to Kira. And Monica Clancy is a senior SLT with an acute background, now working in the Midwest Community Healthcare. In January 2022, Monica and the adult team established Ireland's first community-based FEES service. The team received a HSC Healthcare Excellence Award in 2022 in the Innovation in Service Delivery category. So you're very welcome as well, Monica. So we'll start with you, Patricia. Can you give us a description of what FEES actually is and its relevance within SLT practice?
Okay. Hi, everybody. So FEES is an instrumental swallow assessment whereby a flexible scope is passed through the nose to the pharynx and onto the larynx to evaluate anatomical and physiological aspects of swallowing, what the person does when they swallow saliva or when they swallow fluids and food. And also it's a tool that's used for biofeedback and to trial out different techniques. So it has many, many aspects to it, but that's it in a nutshell. You were interested in thinking about how it applies to practice.
Exactly, yeah.
I was exposed to FEES and endoscopy probably about 12 years ago with Professor Susan Langmore, and I was so intrigued by the fact that we could actually see the vocal cords and the larynx and see what happened when we swallowed that I was totally blown away by it. So people ask me, what is the one thing that you couldn't do without in your practice? And I would say nasendoscopy because of its application to swallowing and to examination of the upper larynx, airway and voice problems. I mean, we could talk all day about its clinical application, but maybe I'll just stop there.
Yeah, and it's great to hear you speak so passionately about it. Could you maybe outline a bit further around the population that you work with and maybe common swallowing disorders that you encounter and how FEES helps in diagnosis and treatment of that?
Mm-hmm. So where I work in the Mater, we have a big inpatient fee service. We cover inpatients and outpatients. On average, we have about 7 or 8 fee slots a week for our inpatients. So as you know, the Mater is a very busy, large hospital, and it has a number of specialities. So from a fees perspective, it could be a stroke patient. It could be a patient post heart and lung transplant, spinal cord injury, cardiothoracic surgery, a frail elderly person admitted from a nursing home with an aspiration pneumonia, patients with COPD. So Parkinsonism, neurodegenerative conditions. So there's a plethora of disorders and presentations. So I don't see just one type of patient. As a person who is involved in the fee service as inpatients with my colleagues, we see a range of disorders. In terms of how it helps our management, I mean, we probably will talk later on about videofluoroscopy versus fees and so on and so forth. But from the point of view, if I hear a patient has a dysphonia following, we'll say, a recent surgery, my first port of call would be, let's do a fees so we can evaluate the larynx and the vocal folds. I would then be able to track that patient in terms of further investigations, as in ENT, diagnostics, identify silent aspiration, so things that you won't get at the bedside. So there are numerous advantages to doing a fees at the bedside for patients who are very unwell and who maybe cannot move to videofluoroscopy.
Okay, thank you. Sheila, so I suppose Patricia has kind of described what fees is, but can you maybe talk us through a typical assessment and how you tailor your approach to individual patient needs? Maybe if there's any strategies that you employ to ensure patient comfort or cooperation.
Yeah, I was thinking about this. Like in our hospital, we've had fees for, it's kind of been in the last 2 years, so it's not as well established as in the Mater. And we're only dealing with an inpatient population. So we cover all inpatients, but we have found, kind of echoing what Patricia said, that it's mainly kind of the stroke and then the neurosurgery / ITU cohort are our biggest users of fees. We use the Langmuir protocol going through it in terms of the kind of the voice tasks and presentation of consistencies. So there's different voice tasks you have the patient do, you know, say duna, duna, Paul is tall, E, because you're looking at different points as you pass the scope. So we'll try to make sure that we rehearse those with patients first. You know, obviously, once the scope is in there, that's not the time you want to practice. You want to make that as efficient as possible. One thing really came to mind when you were asking this was, you know, people often wonder about things like aphasia and cognitive issues. Now, you know, we have made our consent leaflet as easy read as possible, but what I found was great is the Mayo Clinic have a video up on YouTube of a fees. And I had a gentleman who had, you know, a severe mixed aphasia and apraxia post-stroke last year. And, you know, literally he could say yes, and that was it. And we showed him the video. We brought him up the scope, the sterilized scope in its packaging to show him. And he consented and he participated in the exam really well. So that was great. And I don't, we also have like, we have two different scopes in CUH at the moment. One of them is slightly wider than the other. So, you know, you'll kind of think, consider, depending on the patient, if you feel it's someone, you know, who's a little bit anxious about the procedure, to go for the narrower one, make sure there's plenty of lubrication, lots of reassurance beforehand and during it. So there are all the things, but I think like that particular gentleman's case was one that stands out to me because, you know, it showed with the right tools, he was able to participate in the consent process and to have the procedure.
Yeah, and I suppose from my own background as well in adult intellectual disability, would you have experience of not performing a scope on anyone
with an ID?
I might have to hand over to my colleagues on that. We haven't had to date in CUH. I mean, obviously, when something you're performing at the bedside, you know, you can make sure that a carer is present and or maybe assisting them feeding, if that helps. Not a situation I've encountered. So maybe Patricia, Monica, or Kira might like to contribute there.
Maybe I'll come in there, Breed. Yes, we have carried out fees on patients with cognitive impairment. And one of the, I suppose, the things you have to consider when you're deciding whether you're going to carry out a fees in a patient is if there is, you know, a cognitive impairment. And it's one of those possible contraindications that's listed, let's say, in the RCSLT document. But we found that, you know, mild cognitive, even mild to moderate patients can cooperate. Sometimes what will happen is they may be hypersensitive and the scope just even tipping, you know, just entering the nasal cavity, they'll react to that. And that'll give you a sign. And you can always even test that before you bring a scope to them. Just see how they would react to, you know, something just a cotton bud or something just touching the nose, because That would be the one thing that we would find that would be an indication for us that the patient is not going to tolerate a scope entering the nasal cavity. But for us, we would say, if in doubt, don't just because somebody has a cognitive impairment, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't do a fees on them. You may have to approach it a little bit differently, and your exam may be shorter, so you'd modify it based on the presentation. But it shouldn't be an absolute no. Every patient should be given the, I suppose, the consideration and the evaluation before the exam. And as Sheila was touching on there, that preparation of the patient is very important, and you'll get a much better outcome if you come to the patient relaxed, even though you mightn't feel it. But that preparation of everything beforehand, making sure you've got all your consumables. Again, Sheila mentioned the gel, so that's a lubricant to ease the transmission of the scope through the nasal cavity. So having everything organized makes for a much better exam for the patient.
I often find as well, Patricia, like if I've had patients who have that little bit nervous, when you're inserting the scope, sometimes I just stop and kind of, hold it there for a minute or two. And then as they get comfy, they can get more accustomed and, you can pass the scope a little further. And obviously telling the patient what you're doing at each stage as well. But I do find that sometimes, once you just kind of sit it out for maybe 30 seconds, they'll relax and you can keep going then.
Okay, thank you, Sheila and Patricia. And Kira, I know you just did your fees training last year. Can you describe any specific challenges or issues that you have encountered when conducting the fees procedure, or if you've any maybe case-specific information?
Sure. So often, well, not often, occasionally, you can have difficulty passing the scope through the nasal cavity. You can pick up secretions as you're passing through the nasal passages, and the lens can get what we call gunked or sort of bogged up with the secretions, and that can be tricky. Obviously, then when you're viewing the structures and assessing in your low position, looking at the glottis and the vestibule, looking for evidence of penetration. So that can be challenging, and there can be some techniques employed to try and manage that situation. So I find often an effortful squeezing swallow can be useful to try and clean the lens. Sometimes retracting back into the nasal passage can be helpful. And Susan Langer actually suggested that in her talk last year in Limerick. A liquid wash, if it's an appropriate consistency, and some jelly maybe can be helpful to try and clear the scope from the gunk or the secretions or the bolus material that might have accumulated on the lens. Other than that, sometimes, there can be atypical nasal anatomy. It can be tricky actually passing the scope. So sometimes I find myself trying the other nasal passage to see if that an easier passing. Sneezing, I find, can be sometimes problematic, where patients sneeze as I'm passing the scope. But I've learned to try and manage that by just kind of pausing for a moment until they kind of overcome that and then continue to advance. So, yeah, that's just a few challenges that I've come across myself in my
Okay.
practice so far. Yeah.
Thanks, Kira. That does sound quite challenging. And I suppose access to and availability of fees is also a factor to consider. Monica, you were involved in setting up the community-based fees. Can you tell us about your experience with that and maybe some of the challenges that you encountered as well?
Yeah, sure. Like, I suppose at the outset, when we started thinking about developing the service, there was no access to fees locally for service users in the Midwest. So that was the kind of starting point. At the time, there was no access to outpatient or community video fluoroscopy. Now that has since changed, thankfully. So when we went into planning the service and planning the sort of business case, we wanted to work hard to ensure that whatever service we did develop, that it would be accessible to any adult over the age of 18 who needed it across the Midwest. We were looking for funding through a particular division within communities. So, I mean, we weren't 100% sure from the outset whether that would limit who the service was available to, but we did put forward our business case and state that we wanted it to be available to all adults who needed it. So we were quite clear on that from the very beginning. And I suppose having set the service up, we've tried to follow through on our promises in the business case, in our implementation plan. So we have a mobile model. So we have sort of two stationary units and two sites that, you know, they stay put. And then we have sort of three outreach sites that we travel out to with mobile equipment. So if you are a service user living in Thurles, you do not have to travel to Limerick for your fees. We will actually go into a clinic out in Thurles. So I think, and, you know, anecdotally, having spoken to service users and we have gathered feedback and service experience data, but anecdotally, I will say that people really appreciate not having to go into Limerick City for a procedure and just being able to access that locally. I guess, you know, we did try to work kind of to a certain amount of scale as quickly as possible to ensure that we weren't kind of building large waiting times in this service. We wanted it to be efficient. We didn't want people waiting like months and months and months for a fee. So I think we've achieved that to some extent. You know, there are certain times when, due to like lots of different factors like staffing and available space and all those things, that you know, a person might have a waiting time of a number of weeks. But I think overall access is pretty good to fees in the Midwest. And as Patricia mentioned earlier, it is also a therapeutic tool. So we are able to offer repeat fees to people who've already had that test done in order to evaluate therapy outcomes. So that's really satisfying.
Okay, great. And in relation to the mobile fees, is that like a big endeavor, kind of the traveling around and just transporting everything?
It is not like, I live in Lahinch and it's not uncommon for me to set off occasionally, like when we do a clinic in Thurles, to drive to Thurles and do that clinic, which I think is, goodness, I could be wrong now, but something like 120 kilometers. So it's a big distance. But I think, you know, ultimately what we want to achieve is, you know, clinicians in those locations trained in fees who could, you know, run a fees clinic without the need for people to travel very long distances, the clinicians to travel, I mean. So I think that's the end goal. But for now, we're to be fair, the team has been so flexible and so willing to accommodate and, you know, recognizing the accessibility to service users being a really important factor. So I think we really deliver person-centered service. But yeah, I think hopefully we would have, say, two SLTs out in sort of the North Tip area. We would have, you know, minimum of two in each kind of area in the Midwest to be able to deliver that service using a mobile system.
Okay. Yeah. And say in relation to your team then as well, like the kind of medical team involvement, for example, you know, do you need like medical team to sign off on things, or if there are any kind of incidental findings, do you have access to ENT mm-hmm. to review images, things like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we, usually it's, you know, a community-based physician of some kind. So it can be a GP to sign off. It can be an integrated care consultant. It can be a rehab consultant, which, you know, rehab in the Midwest is a community-based service. So we would absolutely have a thorough sort of referral form encompassing the individualized risk assessment for that patient. And that would need to be co-signed with the managing physician. So that's first and foremost. If we don't have that, the fees does not happen. In terms of, like, I guess I'll just mention our sort of, we do have a fairly robust triage system. And I think that stands out in the community because we are quite selective about who we will and will not see for fees. And we are careful not to scope people in the community who might have pre-existing risks of things like epistaxis or have very complex sort of maybe medical and surgical stuff going on in the background. So we would always be careful and select suitable patients. And if they do appear to be too complex on paper, then we're going back to the referring SLT looking for an alternative route. So that might be video fluoroscopy. In the event that we do see something, and we have seen some very interesting things and very unexpected things like us all here on the call, I'm sure. But in that event, we have a very, very supportive two ENT consultants who are supporting the service, and we have access to them, you know, via a meeting that happens once every 2 months. So that's a clinical meeting that we have set up. We might bring 4 or 5 or 6 patients to that meeting for discussion. We'll bring our video clips, our images, and our concerns. And sometimes it's really straightforward that, you know, we just see something and we're not sure, and, you know, we should check, and that's the right thing to do. So we bring that, and they might just say, no, that's completely normal, nothing to worry about. And alternatively, they might say, yeah, we need to see that person in clinic, and they will listen directly from that meeting. So I think that's a really, really important quality aspect for community fees, is that you do have a really good link with ENT in particular. I think other disciplines are important too, and hopefully we'll work on forming those networks in time. But I think first and foremost, ENT colleagues are super important in this whole thing, just to make sure that what we're doing is of a high standard, of good quality and safe. And I would just, yeah, I would commend the ENT team there in UHL for supporting us with that. And it's been incredibly useful and a huge learning meeting for us all, where we go in and we all come away with new information. So it's always great.
Great, yeah, good support system as well for you guys. And following on from that, Kira, just in relation to collaboration with other healthcare professionals, can you maybe talk about that in your setting? So collaboration with like medical staff, ENT, gastroenterology.
Sure. So historically, in Navan, in Our Ladies in Navan, the medical consultants would refer patients, any patients with ENT needs, or any patient requiring ENT opinion would be referred to the Mater ENT team for opinion. So it was agreed with my clinical lead when I was setting up the infrastructure for the fees service that that pathway, you know, is already established, and that we would, you know, continue to use that for any concerns that I might have following my fee studies. So far, I've not, thankfully, had any need to refer to ENT, but it was agreed that, you know, my report would contain screenshots of the anomaly in question, and it would be discussed with the treating consultant that ENT, you know, should be sought. And a copy of that report then would be sent to their ENT colleagues in the Mater. And it was also discussed that possibly, you know, a clip of the structural variant, you know, on the live study would be taken on silo, and it would be communicated to our ENT colleagues that way. Or alternatively, the study would be burnt onto a disc and sent to ENT in the Mater via courier. So there were a few options discussed, and, you know, but the main thing is there is an established pathway there in place already. So that's with regards to ENT. And then GI, we have a GI consultant in Navan. So it would be, again, flagging a concern with the treating consultant, and then the treating consultant liaising with our GI consultant to take it from there. So that's the practice currently in Navan.
Okay, very good. And then Sheila, if we can move on and maybe talk about the comparisons or differences between video fluoroscopy and fees, maybe kind of pros and cons of each. I know you work with both.
Yeah, and I think Patricia alluded to some of those already. So I suppose the great thing about fees, as Patricia said, is if you've any queries about the voice, that you can get that direct look at the vocal cords and get that information for ENT. Obviously, we're not diagnosing an ENT abnormality, but it highlights the need for ENT, and it gives you some information to bring to them. Again, like, it's, you know, the advantage of fees is it's the more conservative exam. You can assess someone just with their own secretions. You don't have to put them at any further risk of aspiration. in that way, it can also be used, say, in terms of airway management, like looking at how someone's secretions respond, say, with the speaking valve on and off. It's great for patients, you know, who can't access VFU because they're too unwell, or, you know, if you have other issues, like if patients are in high support seating, if we have bariatric patients, they can't necessarily access video fluoroscopy. It's more repeatable because you've no radiation involved. Obviously, you know, there is the element of discomfort more so than a video fluoroscopy. I suppose the thing about FIS that I really like as well is it's kind of, you know, if you're someone who tolerates the scope really well, you can fatigue test them, you know, you can watch them eating a meal, or, you know, kind of maybe more so than in video fluoroscopy where you're under time pressure in a radiology suite and you're thinking, oh, well, we'll give them three sips and then we'll turn the camera back on and look at them. I suppose obviously video fluoroscopy, you know, if you've queries then to do with anything esophageal, you're going to want to go video fluoroscopy for that full like pharyngoesophageal view. And I suppose just to bear in mind, you're not going to see the oral stage in the same way as a FIS. You know, you'll see what's happening within the mouth, obviously radiologically on video fluoroscopy. That said, with, you know, with FIS, you're there, you're in front of the patient. So they're the main things I can think of at the moment.
Thanks. And Patricia, then in relation to FIS training, I know you're quite involved in that. Can you tell us about access to training for SLTs here in Ireland? And maybe then once somebody is trained, kind of what do they have to do to keep up with competencies?
Okay. And I suppose training is a hot topic at the moment, and everyone here in this panel will agree with me, I think, on this. I mean, it's wonderful to see in the last year or two a number of sites across the country getting equipment. And so we have centres who have equipment but are desperately needing to have their clinicians trained up. So in a way, a little bit the cart came before the horse, but that's, well, never say no to equipment if it comes our way. So there are challenges for sure at the moment because we don't have enough therapists in the country who are at the level, say what's called a level three expert clinician, who can go and train somebody in a site that has no functioning fee service. We don't have enough. And also those level three, like there's a number of level three clinicians in the country, but they're employed by their institution. So they're not going to be, I mean, we are let go every so often, but being honest, if I or Monica or Sheila or anyone else goes and trains off site, then who's going to do the work that we would be doing in our institution? And so you'd be looking at something like a backfill into that post. So I suppose what we've been doing is we've been really, I think, trying to meet the needs as best we possibly can. But I think we've now come to a point where something has to change. And I think in order for the fee services to develop across the country, a serious look needs to be taken at how we're going to train speech and language therapists to carry out endoscopy, not just for swallowing, but also for upper airway and voice disorders, because that's the way it's going now with the new SLT-led clinics in hospitals, and then the pathway to community. And in time, SLTs in community will be carrying out endoscopy, no doubt, to treat voice disorders. So, you know, there is a huge need. I don't have the answers to it, obviously. It's something that needs to be addressed, I think, at a national level. And I think it is certainly being looked at. So we in Ireland are following the RCSLT guidelines in terms of competency training and then what should happen after you're trained. So RCSLT would recommend that an average person, and this is just a guide, it's, it, you know, for some people they're going to need many more than this, but they should have at least 12 fees a year. It seems very little when I say that. Please correct me, other people. Have I got that right? Because 12 seems so few. So I'm open to correction on that. So it behoves every clinician who's trained to carry out fees to actually maintain his or her competencies. So it's not like there's going to be somebody watching over you. You as a professional and engaging in advanced practice, which is what it is, has a duty to maintain your competencies. And so if what we would do, say, in the matter, if somebody isn't getting enough, you know, fees exams, as an endoscopist in particular, then a person who is maybe doing more will you know, give over some slots. So it's really important that competency levels are you know, managed in sort of, say, like a big service, like the matter. It's probably more difficult, I would say, in the smaller centres. I don't know if that answers your question, Breed.
Yeah. No, that does. Thank you. And I think you mentioned that you have a training program coming up in July, is it? Or
so we have a 2-day introductory course coming up in July. So we've been running this every 2 years. And so this is probably about our fourth. I know COVID messed up maybe one of the years. So it's about our fourth one. And so the whole idea behind it is that it's 1 day of theory and knowledge. And it's for anyone who wants to learn about fees or wants to maybe have an opportunity to upskill a little bit. And then the second day is geared really towards people who want to get that opportunity to pass a scope on a human. Mm-hmm. And so we have a workshop situation set up. And so, you know, quite a number of people who are now engaged in fees around the country would actually have started with their at the course in the matter. And so the excitement of that workshop when people actually get through the nose to the vocal cords, I mean, it's electric. It's the best part of the course because people just value so much that experience. And I suppose it's coming away saying, I know I can do this. You know, I've done it once, so I know I can do it again. So now there's, you know, there's lots of issues around, you know, and thoughts around whether we should be using more simulation. So thinking about that at the moment, because as more and more people want to be trained, you know, it's probably not feasible to be practicing as much on patients as we are at the moment. So I can see that there will be a bigger role for simulation. So we're looking at that at the moment. That's sort of a development that we hope that'll come on board.
That sounds great. And I'm sure there's a lot of interest in your courses.
Can I just add something in there, just from what Patricia said as well, apart from like that electric moment of getting to see the vocal cords, I think it's really important as a clinician, if you're doing fees, that you've had a fees. You know, I think it's really important that you can say to patients, I know, even at the beginning or at the end of the exam, I know that was a little bit uncomfortable. I've had one done. You know, I think it's important to understand what it's going to be like and to be on the receiving end of it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so important in preparing people for the procedure too, I'm sure. Then I suppose in relation to kind of advancements, so you've mentioned already there, Patricia, about simulation maybe being something upcoming, but any other advancements or changes in techniques or equipment that have impacted your practice in recent years, Monica?
Do you know what? It has and it hasn't changed. You know, the fundamentals, I attended Patricia's course, by the way, in 2015, and Susan Langmore was at that course accrediting it, I think, Patricia, if I'm not wrong. And you know what? And I suppose Susan Langmore's book as well from the 80s, like that is the best fees resource that is out there to date, and it remains so. So I think in many ways, the fundamentals have not really changed that dramatically. But of course, there have been technological advances. The equipment is, you know, we've moved away from the fiber optic scope to the chip and tip or the flexible scope. So it's a digitized image that you're seeing. So the quality is an awful lot better. And then the scope itself is more robust and less prone to sort of breaking and getting damaged. So I think the equipment has certainly become a lot more user-friendly, and of course you're able to record your studies, and the frame by frame at 60 frames per second analysis is available on those new systems. So I think that technologically speaking, they're the kinds of advances that have really helped SLTs to kind of deep dive on their fees analysis and get a really good quality report out of that. I would say, you know, there are newer kind of rating scales that are out there as well. For example, the phases scale, James Curtis and James Borders, I think, are responsible for that one. And I've, you know, had a look at it. I don't think many people are actually using that clinically, but it's there. And there are a number of other sort of rating scales that have come out. But having said all of that, I think certainly what we're using in the Midwest is kind of fairly true to what was happening in terms of the rating scales, you know, probably over the last decade or so. So I think a lot of those are quite robust, but we're always open to new ways of working and kind of always scouting out for sort of new scales and things that we can do to improve the reliability of our studies and, you know, even give us shortcuts to get the answers that we're looking for. Yeah, look, I think that was it in a nutshell for me. You know, it's a quite a robust test. It works from what Susan Langmore started doing it 40 years ago plus. You know, she really kind of fine-tuned the study many, many years ago, and it hasn't changed that dramatically from then, but very much open to contradiction on that from the experts on the panel.
Yeah, would any of you add anything to that?
No, I agree. I think Monica covered it really well there. I certainly agree the chip and tip scopes, so the flex. So that's why there's this, you know, I suppose discussion whether we should continue to call it fibre optic endoscopic evaluation of swallowing versus flexible endoscopic. So we're really not using, well, very few people are using fibre optic scopes, those scopes with the fibre optic bundles. Most people are using the chip and tip or video endoscopes, the digital scopes. So there is that debate going on whether we should now be consistently saying flexible. I would think we should be because it's not a fibre optic scope that we're using anymore. I think at the end of the day, swallowing is swallowing, isn't it? And I think advances will be around further developments in technology. I'm putting it out there, if somebody can come up with a scope that allows us to clear secretions at the same time as evaluate swallowing, that would be really cool. The vases that Monica alluded to, there are some great tools out there, and I think we've all taken on board the Yale scale, the residue rating, the New Zealand secretion. So there have been developments from, say, the Murray scale, which was the main scale that was used for secretion rating. So there have been those developments along the way. But I would think technology, maybe AI, you know, all of those advances are going to be the thing that'll probably make, at the end of the day, people are going to be swallowing in the same way normally or disordered, eating food and drink. I suppose one thing, I tell me when you want me to stop talking, because I tend to, okay. I tend to get carried away. A thing that we didn't mention I didn't mention in terms of the fees exams was the use of ice chips. So we really have embraced in our work, the use of ice chips. So patients who have been NPO for a long period of time, who have high risk of aspiration, you know, very maybe critical care myopathy, you know that if they have an aspiration, it's going to really, you know, imbalance things for them. So we give ice chips to patients. We can talk about that again, but that is a fantastic I suppose, addition to our assessment. And of course, Susan Langmore would have talked about that as well. So it's not that we've invented those trials, but it's an important aspect of swallow assessment. As Sheila was saying, you're looking at secretions. You may not give the person any food or drink, but you can find out an awful lot about their swallow function. And with secretion, how they're managing secretions and how they manage ice chips. Does it generate a swallow? Do they aspirate them? Can they clear the residue? And if they aspirate ice chips, it's not the end of the world.
Something else that comes to mind there is the BioZoon. Do any of you have experience using that?
I've used it actually. I've had a patient with a really severe dysphagia. Like he kind of had a triple whammy. He had a meningioma. Oh, I'm trying to remember this. Like kind of cerebellar meningioma. Then he had neurosurgery for that. Then had a stroke. And ended up in ITU. So kind of pretty much everything that could go wrong around his cerebellum did.
Okay.
And actually we were using BioZoon with him, but interestingly, we never thought of looking at it on fees. But he was someone where we did loads of secretions and ice chips. And I think, I don't know what anyone else has thought, like Patricia, I know you're in the process of looking at pharyngeal electrical stimulation in the matter as well. Like I think having fees really brought that home to us as well, because you just see the sensory response so clearly, and we're just looking at people going, oh my god, we need to get the pharyngeal electrical stimulation for them in order to be able to treat this.
Okay.
You know, we have all the motor tools, we have Biscuit, we have CTAR, you know, but to treat the sensory aspect.
Yeah,
we've used BioZoon with a couple, but it would actually, it's actually a really good point to actually look at it on feet.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see.
Then just in relation to research and keeping up to date with best practice and any kind of personal involvement in research.
Well, I think actually in fairness for the three of us who are on the working group, it's actually great learning for us, like going through a competency document and a framework and not just adapting it. But, you know, when you're looking at it going, actually, this isn't worded that clearly. And, you know, how could we word it? My general thing, like always being, you know, signed up to tables of contents for dysphagia or whatever relevant journals are, I think would be a great idea to have something like the equivalent of a SIG or the Clinical Excellence Networks in the UK for FEIS here, especially as, you know, it's a growing area and we kind of are in little of islands in a way. So, you know, again, the working group has been great for putting us in touch with each other, but I think it would be lovely to have some sort of national group around that and, you know, presenting case studies and that. I was at the UK Swallow Research Group last month, so there was some interesting papers there around, for example, Lisa Bergstrom talking about the reliability of the DOS for FEIS, which was quite reassuring because we'd kind of been using the DOS at CUH, even though it's never been officially validated for FEIS. They're kind of my main ideas. Monica, was there something you wanted to add there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like when I was just looking and thinking about this, the very first thing that came to my mind was networking. And probably because we've been working, Sheila and Patricia, on the working group closely. But even, you know, I'm part of an international, it's a community, our mobile fees special interest group. And that has been incredible networking, but for learning and keeping up to date with research and service developments in other jurisdictions. So I think that, for me anyway, I'm probably not the best person who's going to sit down and read a load of journal articles, but I love listening to my colleagues and talking to them about FEIS because I always learn something new. But I think doing a course like, say, Patricia's course in the matter is, you know, invaluable for people who are looking to start out in FEIS and learn more about it. And I think, you know, that's definitely a very good starting point. I think social media has become a massive resource for learning about all things SLT, really, but in particular, FEIS and swallowing is like, there are lots of sort of, what's the current term for like a dysphagia influencer, but like the ENS Humberts and, do you know, there's loads
George
of
Barnes.
Really, yeah, exactly.
Sorry.
But there's loads of entertaining content out there to help you learn about swallowing and dysphagia and FEIS and video and all of those things. So that's certainly the way I like to learn, and I lean towards that. And I just have written down the Langmore book again. That's it's like the Bible of FEIS, and you can't go wrong by opening up that one. For us in the Midwest, we have a research project that we started 2 years ago. We just wrapped with the sort of follow-up data collection, and we're hoping to do some analysis on that. And in brief, all that is just we have 65 participants who were, you know, we captured clinical and process data at the day of the FEIS, and then again at a 6 month follow-up phone call. So hoping to have some useful sort of findings from that we will hopefully share you know, with the community, just to kind of let people know how clinically, how do people get on with these, but also what were the sort of operational outcomes as well of some of that. So hopefully we'll be able to share some of that soon.
Yeah, great. Brilliant.
Breed, I might just jump in there if you don't mind. I'm just speaking on behalf of the SLTs recently signed off on their, you know, practical skills training. Just with regards to maintaining competencies and keeping, you know, keeping in touch with, you know, research and advancing their skills. You know, I feel that there could be more sort of access to fees, like advanced fees interpretation courses, you know, here in Ireland. I don't know if you're familiar with the Instrumental Diagnostic Education Academy, Valeria Krivolovic. She's quite well known on social media. I recently did an advanced fees interpretation and report expertise course with her online, which basically consisted of watching a study and identifying sort of findings that you would judge to be salient, and then watching another version of the same study that's been partially edited by Valeria, where she's edited it and is drawing your attention to the salient findings, and then demonstrates some report writing examples of how to describe the findings. And then that's followed by a discussion with Ed Bice on that same study around the main findings. I just found the course to be excellent, and I feel like it could be easy enough achieved here if there were some CENs or SIGs, you know, around advanced practice in fees, you know. I just thought it was really, really, really useful. And I hope she will be doing more of them, because I'd highly recommend them, especially for me, as I was sole practitioner. I'm on my own doing fees in Navan. So, you know, even more so for myself, I just found it really, really useful just to facilitate my learning, and just to help consolidate and maintain my learning, you know, and develop it further.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think all of the special interest groups are so important. But I suppose it can be difficult to get people involved, you know, when people are giving up their time voluntarily and stuff. But hopefully something will develop. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
And then we'll finish up. But maybe just if anyone had any really interesting case that stands out in your mind that you came across on fees that you'd like to share.
I don't have an unusual one, but that gentleman I talked about with the really severe dysphagia, it kind of drove us more towards getting pharyngeal electrical stimulation. But I remember, it's, you know, that where you were talking about kind of creating a calm environment and everything for the patient. And for some reason I found, I don't know about anyone else, like Kira, I'm relatively recently trained too. For some reason, I managed to be very calm doing my scoping, no matter like who else was behind me. You know, if the medical team were like, oh, look, we'll just have a look in. But I remember with this gentleman where we had done like several months of rehab on biscuit and CTAR and Masako and ice chips and EMST. And this was about 3 months later, and I went in to do his fees. And the minute I got in there, I just saw the secretions, and it was just the biggest heart sink. And, you know, just having to go through that procedure and kind of, now I can't remember, he was kind of half looking at it at the time, but, you know, just going through that procedure and thinking, oh, you know, it's just not any better. And it was actually quite interesting, because I brought our neuropsychologist in with me when we were showing him the procedure afterwards, because, you know, we'd all invested so much hope in this. And I suppose this is more to do with the patient case rather than the actual procedure itself. Yeah. But yeah, like that was really helpful for me to bring in the neuropsychologist and talk, say to her, like, right, how are we going to talk to him about this?
Yeah.
You know, he was looking at it going, yeah, that doesn't look good, does it?
What does it mean?
Yeah, so that was a kind of particularly, I suppose, emotionally involved one for me.
Yeah, there isn't a particular case. There's lots of interesting I suppose, anecdotes, but you know, everyone here who's doing fees will appreciate this. You know, you get this, you pass the scope, and we say in this case, the nasogastric tube, as it turned out, was wrapped around the epiglottis. So you can see a bit of the NG tube, and then you can't see any more of it. And you can see a little bit over here, and you're trying to not, you know, say, oh my God, but you know, by everybody's face, and you're looking and you're trying not to show the shock, but also, where is the NG? Like, what's happened? And like, everybody will have stories like this. So it literally was wrapped around. So it's, you know, call one of the doctors, let them look, and then withdraw the NG and withdraw the scope. But it's just that, you know, you see something and you think, oh my God, or you see a tube. I mean, as somebody alluded to earlier on, you don't know what you're going to find. I mean, you're going in to assess swallowing, but, you know, people don't know what's going on inside their larynx, their throat, their pharynx. And so we may be the first person to actually to identify that there is something abnormal. There was an image. I didn't scope the patient, but, you know, people would ask me to look at images. So I looked at this image, and every endoscopist knew it was abnormal. And couldn't make out the epiglottis. It was just, you know, very disordered appearance. And, you know, obviously ENT were consulted, and the patient had a cancer of the epiglottis. So, you know, if that wasn't, you know, identified, if it wasn't consulted with ENT, you know, you could, and that patient didn't know they had this problem. So, I mean, we are privileged in a way to be in the position we're in that we can identify things. And people have alluded earlier on to that relationship with ENT. And I suppose it's something that I would say to people, you know, setting up a service, you really need to seriously think about that, because we're in a part of the body that's not, you know, it's not our main skill set. We're not able to diagnose pathology. We can see something that might be abnormal. And so we do need to have that pathway clearly defined, as Monica alluded to earlier on. And I think it for us as well, and I'm sure with others, it's really strengthened that relationship and that collaboration and great learning across the disciplines. But so unusual findings, I suppose that's the bit I'll finish with there.
Can I just add one example of an impactful case, and I'll keep it as brief as possible, but it wasn't like an unusual finding, but a patient who had had a stroke 11 years ago and had been referred in from a nursing home for community fees, and had been on level 2 thickener for 11 years. And when we scoped the patient, his swallowing was perfect and he did not need thickener at all.
Something I see within adult ID, it just, people are put on something historically and then no instrumental done to see if it's actually necessary. Yeah.
Sure. No, I see that too often in Navin. It's just, I think it's testament, it's symptomatic of a lack of access to instrumentals and overuse of a clinical bedside to you know, sort of overdiagnose a dysphagia severity and aspiration, you know, so it's happening too often. You know, I would find that they would come onto my radar when they reached the hospital, and I would find the same. I would do an instrumental, and whether it be a video or a fees, and find that they don't actually need the thickener. You know, so it's very satisfying to be that therapist, but it's also sad as well and unfortunate that that's how they're managed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, just even highlighting the importance of instrumental, and obviously to try and use it if we do have that access. Okay, so thank you all so much for chatting this evening. It's been really interesting and I've learned a lot, but also want to learn more. So thank you all.
Thank you. Thanks for hosting.
Thank you, Bree. Yeah.
Thank you to Patricia Gillivan-Murphy, Sheila Robinson, Monica Clancy and Kira Landy for joining me this evening. You can listen back to our other podcasts by following our social media channels on X, formerly Twitter, Instagram and Facebook, or by searching IASLT in Conversation on Spotify.